And good afternoon, and welcome to Angel Answers. And I'm your host, Amy Toy, and I have a great guest, a very diversified guest, actually. He's a John Backman. He wrote the book, Why Can't We Talk? Christian Wisdom on Dialogue as a Habit of the Heart. And John's, you know, coming to us with a very, very diverse background. He is a longtime writer and associate of an Episcopalian monastery. We'll talk about that. And he writes extensively on contemplative spirituality and its ability to help us dialogue across divides. And he's got very, you know, numerous articles and faith-based publications, both progressive and conservative, including the Huffington Post, Episcopal Life, The Living Church, Next Wave, Relevant Magazine.com, and Prism. And he writes a column regularly for UPI's Religion and Spirituality and maintains a blog, too. Welcome, John. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you, Amy?
Good, good. You have a different, you have an interesting background. Very diverse, which I think
that's for
helped
sure.
you. Yeah, which helped you, which I think helped you write a very objective book, and Why Can't We Talk?
Mm.
And you know, I think that's, you know, I think our backgrounds obviously, you know, take us on, as you called it before we started the call, the odyssey, which I think is a good way of looking at it instead of a journey, it's the odyssey. John, so, that's the truth. Like I said, I'm working on my own odyssey, by the way. How did you come up for the, how did the title, Why Can't We Talk, how did that come to you?
Well, that's a good question. I think what happened was, as I started thinking about this, and I started thinking about this years and years ago, actually back when Ronald Reagan was president, of all things, and as I mulled it over the years, the idea distilled itself down to that one question. It was obvious to me, looking at our elected officials, looking at our families, looking at so many spheres of our lives, that we desperately want to talk, and yet we can't talk. And so the question sort of arose out of all of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what grabbed me about the title of your book is Why Can't We Talk? Because I have a difficult father that sometimes he's a blockhead, and it's like, he doesn't get me, I don't get him. And no, seriously, he's a great man, but he's, you know, very old-fashioned in his thinking. Here, his daughter owns a business, you know, right? And I write books, too. I haven't had anything published yet, but that's another story. So he goes, I don't understand. So the reason why I wanted to read your book was maybe to come some kind of common ground with my dad. And let's talk about dialogue for a second here. What
sure.
is dialogue, and how is it different than a debate? I have a friend who is a debater. So how is that different?
Yes, and I go into this in the first chapter of the book because there are a lot of different modes of communication. Right. Debate certainly one of them, and each one of them has its place. It's not like any of them are particularly bad for whatever reason. Debate can be great for having people lay out specific positions so that you listen and kind of noodle out what it is that you think. So the classic debate is one person stands up and gives their the pro side of an issue. The other person stands up and gives the con side of the issue. But there's no real back and forth. With dialogue, both people are really going into the encounter to talk with each other. They're going into it together to explore, rather than going into it on opposing sides to present. So it makes it much more mutual. It makes it more exploratory. And the emphasis is really on the relationship much more than on the individual positions.
Mm-hmm. So debating sometimes could be like an ego play sometimes, you know, to bolster up our ego or something. I mean, that's just been my, you know, especially if you're debating about something you're so passionate or, you know, emphatic about.
Yes, and not that this is actual technically formal debate, but turn on C-SPAN anytime they're showing Congress live and you'll see how much ego is often involved. You know, it's unfortunate. But dialogue is also different from some other forms of communication as well. It's different from conversation in that conversation I think of as flowing pretty much without restriction. You get a bunch of people in a room and they start talking and they could talk about baseball, and before you know it, you're talking about particle physics and you have no idea how you got, you know, to where you went. And it's delightful and it's a blast. But it's not exactly that shared exploration of one another's viewpoints, one another's convictions that dialogue really gets into. Mm-hmm. And the other part about dialogue that I'll say is that what I try to get across in the book is that I'm seeing dialogue as a way of life, not just it's an orientation of heart as well as a method of communication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's, to me, dialogue is really trying to find not a common ground, but a common understanding.
That's well said.
You know, especially with, we're going to go, like I said, I'm going to ask you some different questions you gave me, and I made up some of my own, so this will be good. So how do we get there? How do we get to a healthy dialogue?
I think what we need, and this is the essence of Why Can't We Talk, I think we need a more fundamental change than we have tried to date. We have all kinds of processes to facilitate dialogue, and they're excellent at bringing people together. They're excellent at getting people to brainstorm. Once people are oriented toward dialogue, these things really help when people are at the table. The problem is, how do we get more people to orient that way? We have precious few people oriented that way. You can see it anytime a controversial issue comes up, anytime you watch the news. So the question is, how do we get people to orient that way? And that is where the deeper change comes in. And the core of that change is really in the realm of spirituality, because I think spirituality has a unique role to play in inner transformation. It's been happening for thousands of years, and I think it's there are lessons within that tradition that we can use today.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of spirituality, I'm going to go a little bit into, I'm going to use the G word, God. You know,
people. Yay!
Yay! Well, you know.
No, I know. It's difficult for a lot of people. There's no question.
It is, you know, and how do you think, okay, we talked about that we both have a diverse background. I came back from, you know, here I'm in metaphysics, and, you know, I was a Jehovah's Witness for 10 years, and I was brought up Catholic, so I have a different, diverse background.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to use some biblical examples, how do you think that Jesus was a good example for dialogue? I think he presented, can you give us some examples? I think Jesus presented that, because you do present it very well in the book, I think.
Oh, I just love Jesus for this, because Jesus was obviously not, he wasn't on earth to, assuming that the gospel rendering is accurate, which is a big assumption anyway. Jesus was clearly not on earth to promote dialogue. He was there with a very specific mission to deliver a very specific message. However, there are some really interesting places where I think he learned things by his encounters with people that surprised him, that he did not expect. And to the extent that those encounters represent dialogue, an exchange of views that touch us at in our deepest souls and enable us to change, I think he had them. The one that used to be my least favorite Bible passage of all, and now it's become one of my favorites, is when he meets up with a Canaanite woman. He goes off into this area that has nothing to do with Israel, and you kind of wonder, what on earth is he even doing there? I think it almost looks like he's had enough for a little while of the rigors of ministry, and he's taking a well-deserved break. And so this woman comes up to him who is not from Israel, and she says, look, my daughter is really ill. Can you please heal her? And Jesus says, no, okay, number one, I was only sent to the people of Israel. So this is my understanding of my ministry. And then she keeps badgering him. And he says something about, it's not fair for the for me to give the food for the children and give it to dogs. I mean, in essence, he's calling her a dog for not being a member of the family of Israel. And she comes back at him and says, well, look, even dogs get to lick up crumbs from the master's table. And his response is astonishment. He thought, my gosh, number one, I have not seen this kind of faith in Israel. Number two, I suspect that topic, that retort, turned his view of his ministry to an extent, so that it's not, no longer is it just about Israel, but now maybe he gets a glimpse that his message is for everybody. Mm-hmm. And obviously the ramifications of that for the last two millennia have been earth-shattering, because if he had stuck with it just being a message for Jews, then I think a lot of us would not have been able to tap into it. So I don't know if that's a technically orthodox way of looking at that story, but to me it says something about even Jesus learning things as he went through his life.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I feel that he may, you know, he came down here, you know, and he did learn a lot of things, and that was an interesting story too. You know, I remember studying that and thinking, was he sexist or something? You know,
I know it's really brutal. It's not an easy story to swallow.
Yeah, but it also, I think, depends on who was writing the stories, because if you look at the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, their different accounts of the scriptures, how they tell a story, I think is like a different viewpoint, in my opinion, anyway.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And it's fascinating. And then we go on to the Apostle Paul. How did he kind of use dialogue, too? What's a good example Paul gave us for about dialogue?
Paul is in the same boat as Jesus in that he sensed himself being called to deliver a message, specifically the message of Christ. So he was not really about dialogue, but he seemed to have a knack for going into areas and finding, as you said, that common understanding and tapping into that common understanding to make his point in a relatively respectful way. So at one point he enters Athens, comes to the place where the philosophers are talking about everything that they want to talk about, all the sorts of speculative philosophy and religious issues. And he's rather distressed by the whole thing because it's not his understanding. But he doesn't lead with that distress. He actually leads with what he hears, and he says something to the effect of, listen, I hear that you're talking a lot about many gods and what they might do, and you even have a statue nearby that says to an unknown god. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to proclaim him to you. Now, at this point, there are a lot of Christians, I think, nowadays, and a lot of religionists in general, who would... When they say, I'm going to proclaim this to you, what they mean is, I'm going to tell you why I am right and you are wrong and why you're going to hell. But I think what Paul did was he engaged the ideas of the Athenians and turned them into a way that he could talk about the gospel. And some of the beautiful passages that he utters during that time. Things like, in him we live and move and have our being, which is quoted as Christian scripture all over the place, was in essence something from the Athenian philosophers. It was a direct quote. So he incorporated all that, and it got him enough of an audience so that at the end, some of them scoffed at him, which is to be expected, but others said, we'd like to hear more about this. They were willing to engage him because he was willing to engage them. And I think that's that's a big part of what dialogue is all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was talks about that he tried to be all things to all people, I believe. And he tried he talks about that. And, you know, I remember when I was studying the scriptures, that's one thing about Paul, because when his conversion happens in Acts, I'm not trying to get off the subject here, but he was really an idiot, a jerk, you know, to Christians. And, you know, he really was. And God just kind of blinded him with his light and, you know, called him forth. He was Saul, and then he turned into Paul, I believe. So he was really, he had an inner transformation with dialogue and how to be with people. And I think his background, like our backgrounds, John, you and I, can help other people to understand where they come from. At least that's what I would hope. That would be my hope with this show, is to bring people to a closer understanding of spirituality. Because you can talk about these things. You can talk about spiritual things without having a shotgun next to you ready to shoot the person, you know, because they're not getting your point of view.
Boy, that's for sure.
Yeah, and you talk about that, too, and we'll get into that in just a moment.
Oh, good.
You know, why are we having so much trouble talking and then listening?
I think there are a couple of reasons for this. One is, I think there's a basic fight-or-flight response that is just absolutely human. When I speak at bookstores and various other places, I'll often run people through a little exercise to get them in the frame of mind and I ask them to imagine that they're in a room with somebody whose opinions drive them berserk. And out this person comes with one of those loud, obnoxious opinions. And I ask them, how do you feel? And they feel angry, trapped, suffocated. I get this clutch right in my solar plexus, and I feel like I'm going to pass out, and my heart starts racing. It's that so human response to things. And I think over the last 20 or 30 years, I think we've exacerbated that because we've had so many opportunities to be angry about various issues. And it can be any of the hot button issues that you can name today, whether it's abortion, whether it's LGBTQ issues, whether it's issues of war and peace, you name it, and people are angry about it. And I think we've reinforced that fight or flight so that we're even angrier than we used to be. So when we have those instant responses, it's very, very hard for us to get to a place where we can actually listen. And that's one of the reasons that I feel that the inner transformation from the spirit outward is so important, because it gives us a chance to detach from that sort of thing. It's almost the classic Buddhist idea of non-attachment. If you are attached to God, if you're attached to the divine, if you are not attached at all, if you're following the Buddhist way of thinking, then it becomes much easier to hold these things lightly, even if they're your deepest convictions.
I think that for myself included, you know, I grew up with a very narrow-minded family. And then as I got older, you know, I questioned my beliefs. For example, I took a class in college about Islamic religion and the law. And that was an interesting, because I wanted to know about these people with 9/11, for example. I wanted to broaden my understanding, because I want to know why people do the way why people do the things they do. And
right.
I think that people today, you're right, they have their convictions. There's like they're closed off from that. And why do you think that? What do you think contributes to that thinking? What do you think? Is there a culture? What is it?
Boy, I think there are a lot of things. I mean, one thing is that we have so many role models about how to do this wrong. Look at Congress, look at screaming talk radio, look at Facebook or Twitter, or people who talk on blog posts. I get a lot of those when I write online. People who really just are out there to make a point, who may not even be reading what you're writing, but their whole point is to sort of vent their spleen, as it were. So I think there's a lot of that. Then there's the anger, and on top of the anger, there's also fear. I think people are afraid, and they should be. It's really very understandable because in a lot of ways, you're talking about, sometimes you're just talking about the casual opinion, but in many other cases, you're talking about people's deepest convictions. And dialogue presents a risk, a threat to those things. If you go into dialogue, there is a chance, however remote, that you will find out that your convictions are wrong. And that means that you're going to have to make some changes. That's a very difficult thing. So I think being attached to those things makes it much, much more difficult to deal with. You know, there's a whole lot of emotional stuff going on here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you think, besides the way, do you think the media is an obstacle to unhealthy dialogue?
I do think so. I don't think that it's in the typical way that many people think of the media. It's like, oh, it's that doggone media bias. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there is media bias, sure, because the media, you know, news is reported by human beings, and we're all kind of biased. We kind of can't avoid it. But it's, I think more of it is the fact that especially news, seems to now come to us in 30-minute, 60-minute segments, so that everybody gets 3 or 4 seconds of a soundbite. And when we listen to that over the course of a long period of time, we start thinking that's the way that issues get framed. So, you know, they become much easier to deal with. You know, abortion, for instance, is a classic example. It seems like there are basically exactly two positions that you can take. One is abortion is murder, and the other one is get your laws off my body. The problem is that while those things might express a grain of truth, there are a whole bunch of other different ways to think about abortion. And this is true of any issue. But they don't get talked about because there's not enough room in the media, at least in the broadcast media, to talk about it. And the fact of the matter is print is shrinking. Even stories on the web are designed for short attention span. So it can be difficult to get the information you need to get the nuance you need.
Yeah, I think we all have attention deficit disorder, you know, at least some of my friends do.
Oh, no kidding. I think we are an ADD culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of us have it.
Yeah. And that goes back to, you know, back in the day, I think, before we had, I love computers. I think they're a blessing, but they're mm-hmm. a curse in a sense, too, because we want, you know, our attention span does go very quickly. We see something, we read it, we're done with it. We make a split-second decision. I think you mentioned that in the book, too. And, you know, you talk about the balanced media diet. You want to explain a little bit about that? I thought there was an interesting kind of caveat there.
Sure, that was kind of fun. And it goes back to the idea that, sure, media is biased because human beings report it. And I think a lot of people get their media, get their news through essentially one source. And it could be Fox News, it could be CNN, it could be all kinds of things. The problem is when you get your news from one source, you are always ingesting that one bias. That one, not even bias so much as a filter through which you see the world. And in fact, it's the filter through which you also see the quote-unquote other side. So if, for instance, let's say I'm reading Mother Jones magazine, you know, a proud bastion of liberalism, and I read what they say about conservatives, and that's all I read about conservatives, then I'm going to believe I haven't formed my own opinions about conservative thinkers. What I've done is I have in my mind the liberal filter of what conservative thinkers think about. So what I recommend is more of a balance for people. So if you are, if people are liberal by persuasion, I suggest, you know, try reading the National Review, try reading the columns of David Brooks, people who are really smart, intelligent, reasonable conservatives. If you're a conservative by nature, try reading Mother Jones or listening to All Things Considered. If you're an American, try listening to Al Jazeera or the BBC or other foreign types of news. This can go, you can play this on just 100 different scales to get the kind of more of an idea of what's going on. And what happens is when you do that, you start realizing that the people you've always thought so badly about, number one, you're getting their thinking unfiltered by anybody, so you can see it as it is. And number two, you start realizing that actually they're not, in most cases, they're pretty reasonable. You may not agree with what they say, but it's not totally ridiculous, as other media might have you believe. So the more you see that, I think the more you realize, wow, you know, there are a lot of ideas out there. I am just one person with one set of ideas. There are a whole lot of other ideas out there. They're pretty amazing, and it almost drives you into dialogue with people to find out more, to become more curious.
Yeah, and that's what I, like I said, you want to have a, you want to gain an understanding. You may not agree with their point of view. You may not even want to go there, but it's good to just keep an open mind, and you know that's what. So I created the show. We got a diverse topics. You know,
opening the mind,
opening the mind to the people. You know, so. It's a beautiful thing if you're I think like you said there's examples of what not to do. Let's find out what we can do to change our thinking and our views maybe, and be more understanding.
You go
in the book and you refer to chapter 4 quite a bit. What are some key points in chapter 4 that are so important towards dialogue?
I think the key to chapter 4 is it's all about the spiritual dimension. In some ways, it's the crux of the book because it is about that making that inner transformation. And I start by talking about a lot of the virtues that tend to lend themselves to dialogue. Like for instance, the one that I love is humility. Because humility is so misunderstood. A lot of people think about it in terms of low self-esteem or humiliation, when really what it's talking about is simply a clear self-assessment, an understanding of who we are, our place in the universe. And I break that down to two things. One is I'm only one person, which gets us away from thinking that we're the center of the universe. And the other one is, I am one person, which gives us the power to not try to do everything, but to do what we can to make our one person's difference in the world. So there, I list a number of virtues, and then I suggest that one way to come about this inner transformation is through spiritual practices that people for millennia have used to make that happen. And the effect of what they do is that these practices open your heart to God, and in the process, God opens God's heart to us. And that encounter changes us so that we start to look more like God. We start to have more of those virtues of compassion and connection and a passion for justice. Those things that coincidentally make for excellent dialogue. So it really turns us into people of dialogue. And I don't think this is written from a Christian point of view because that's what I know. But I really do think that this applies to just about any faith tradition. Anybody who can read this, my guess is that your listeners are sufficiently spiritually sophisticated so that they could read this. Even if they do not follow a Christian practice, they can read this and adapt it to some of the practices that they follow.
Definitely, and that's, you know, it's a really, I mean, even some Christian-based literature from my past I've read, you know, about boundaries, you know, they talk about that, you know, there's that book Boundaries or something like that, I can't remember who wrote it right now, but it's a Christian-based book. And sometimes I think, too, just because it says Christianity or Christian-based doesn't mean it's not spiritual, it's just, it's a different point of view. So, you know, you get
it is a different point of view, and... Yeah. And, you know, it's so hard to blame people for reading the word Christian and thinking, oh, I'm not going there. Because the Christendom, as we all know, has been filled with centuries of oppression and power and the struggle for control. The thing that I find such a blessing is that there's also been these centuries of monks and nuns and mystics and sages and people like that who have aimed at union with God, union with the divine as their life goal. And that, I think, has made a profound difference in their lives, and it has made them reflect the virtues that I think we can tap into their wisdom to be able to get there ourselves.
Yeah. Speaking of your background, I just want to talk about your... What's an Episcopalian monastery? I find that interesting. I didn't even know this thing existed until I wrote. I'm like, what?
You and everybody else. I know. People look at me cross-eyed every time I put that out there, and I can't blame them. I mean, there are not a lot of them, but there is a fairly decent number of them. It is not unlike a Catholic monastery. In that people go, they commit their lives to living in community with one another. They more or less have most possessions in common, not some of the personal items, but for instance, they own the monastery in common. They dedicate their lives to, again, engaging in a lot of these spiritual practices. So, for instance, they will chant the Psalms from the Hebrew Scriptures five times a day, and they dedicate part of their day to silent prayer, as well as doing the work of the monastery and outreach and good works and whatever has to be done. So it really is very, very similar to the idea of the Catholic monastery. It's just under an Episcopalian rubric, so...
Okay. Yeah, no. My mother used to say there's differences with all religions, but the only difference between Catholicism and Episcopalian and Lutheran is that we have a pope and they don't. Okay, Mom.
I've also heard some wag once say that Episcopalianism is all the pageantry, half the guilt.
Interesting, isn't it?
I suspect it was an Episcopalian who said that, too.
Probably. My mother's a dyed-in-the-wool Catholic, you know. She'll die a Catholic. You know, God bless her. She's a great lady.
Oh, I know. Yeah. And there's just so much, I find so much in Catholicism to love. Yeah, as one of my old friends used to say, it's a bony fish. You have to pick through a lot of bones, but man, the meat that's in there is really worth having because it's rich and it's just full of treasures.
I love it.
It's very cool.
I love it. You had a dialogue. It's called The Turbulent Priest. You want to tell a little bit about the story? I thought that was a fascinating story. No, it was. It was really good because you go into your personal experiences, which is what I do when I'm writing. So that's cool. Tell us a little bit about that. That's great.
I'm so surprised that I love this guy because he is as difficult and obstreperous as the day is long. This was an interim priest who came to our parish. We were between priests at the time, and the Episcopal Church insists that you get an interim because there's a lot of transition to go through. This fellow I would call him a traditionalist, but traditionalist is too liberal a term. He would have been very, very happy in the Church of the Middle Ages, in more ways than one. He was not a fundamentalist in the sense that we use the word today, but he believed strongly in the authority of the church and the fact that we should believe whatever the church says. And he had very conservative opinions about pretty much anything and everything. And he was very dismissive of anybody who disagreed with him. So that made him difficult. And then one Sunday, he was big on evangelism and the idea of getting the word out about the gospel. And he preached on that again, and something clicked in my head, and I said, you know, the whole evangelism thing has bothered me for years, and now I think I know why. And I had an idea, and I wrote to him this long email. Well, he wrote me back a long email, and we went on like this, and it wasn't just evangelism. We went on about anything and everything for probably the better part of maybe 2 years. I had a good time. I learned a lot from him. He, I think, got very frustrated with me because I like to push the theological envelope a lot more than he does. I know I got frustrated with him, and there were times when I thought, you know, I don't know where this is going. It made a difference. However, I noticed afterward that it made a profound difference in a couple of ways. One was that I was going through some real transitions in the way I viewed my faith, the way I viewed the realm of spirit. And I did not want to be the way this priest was. I did not want to believe what he had, but his beliefs were sort of a tether that allowed me the freedom to explore a little more freely and with a little more confidence the things that I was exploring. On the other side, and this is the part that really got to me. I mentioned at one point to him that if he needed to cut off this dialogue, he really should do it at any point because I knew he had many other more important things to do. And what he wrote back to me was, you have no idea how often priests and clergy, including me, long for discussions of this kind.
Wow.
And I realized this is for him, this might be about debate, but it is so much more about connection. And so it started to make me realize that dialogue has this potential to resolve the loneliness that so many of us feel. It enables us to make that connection. And I felt like the whole thing, warts and all, had become such a blessing.
Yeah, and it's amazing because I, growing up Catholic, I always questioned my faith. I had more questions than I had answers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but I had an opposite experience than you did. I was told it was a mystery, which is pretty common. I've heard that quite commonly for those of us, you know, who have questioned, you know, everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I have encountered people in my lifetime that have answered those questions in indirect ways. It's just amazing. And
ooh.
I think it does help with finding that connection to people. Like I said, we all are connected in some way, in my opinion, to one another. We just are different viewpoints. But we do have some commonalities together, you know, in common, I think. That's just what I feel. You know,
I think you're right. And, you know, it's interesting. I get the impression that when you were told it's a mystery, that the underlying message was, it's a mystery, so shut up and just believe it.
Exactly.
Yeah. And my feeling is, wow. I mean, it's all a mystery. So let's play in the sandbox. Let's go explore. Let's find out stuff.
Yeah.
Let's be creative with the way we think. Not tossing out everything, but just kind of reimagining.
Yes, and you know, and I think too, when we come to hot button topics such as abortion and lesbian and gay marriage, you have a really good chapter, like towards the end of the book, and this what captured my interest because you do talk about those the abortion issue. Can you tell us a little bit about how pro-choice and pro-life got together? I thought that was a cool example, John. That was great.
Oh, I am in awe of the people who do this sort of work. There is back, and I cannot remember the year right offhand, but there was a clinic shooting at an abortion clinic where a couple of people were killed and others were injured. This happened in Boston, and people, I think, were utterly traumatized. There may all have been the sense of, wow, this should not happen in Boston. This makes no sense. You know,
right.
We are a bastion of tolerance, and we don't put up with this sort of thing. And in the wake of it, there is this group called the Public Conversations Project, who is made up of it's a loose confederation of change practitioners, a lot of people in family therapy. And they decided that they wanted to try to convene a dialogue about this. So they contacted six women, three representing pro-choice organizations, three representing pro-life organizations, and put to them the invitation of getting together for a limited amount of time, I think a few weeks, to see if there would be any interest in dialogue. All of the women said yes. All of them were terrified. And it was a difficult, difficult experience for them to sit in the same room with people against whom they'd been working for so many years. But what happened over the course of the time was they started, and this seems to be such an important part of dialogue, they started telling each other their stories. Their personal stories, what motivated them, how they felt about things. Things flared up periodically. Little by little by little, they learned how to hear each other. What ended up happening was, I think the dialogue was supposed to last maybe a couple of months. It ended up lasting 4.5 years.
Wow.
And because more and more, even through the times that they wanted to quit completely. These women worked with each other and hung in there and talked and gradually got to the point of not agreement by any means, but a respect for one another. To the extent that at the 1 year anniversary, there was a celebration of a commemoration of the shootings and those who had lost their lives. All of the pro-choice people showed up at that commemoration, of course, but so did two of the pro-life women.
Mm-hmm.
That's not anything that could have happened before this. So it is. It's just miraculous the way that these women learn to talk. They learn to bond. They learn to reach across divides. In a way that was as difficult as can possibly be imagined. But they hung in there and they made it happen.
Yeah, and I think when you are dealing with such a passionate, dialogue, I think to have an open mind for some people is very difficult for them.
Mm-hmm.
I know. And I think it's just very difficult, and especially when people are very passionate and just very convinced about some of their. Sometimes they don't. I don't think they even believe how they come to believe something. They really. I think what your book talks about too is really examining your beliefs, like you did with your priest friend there. I think it really helped you to examine your beliefs, like you said. You were going through a time of searching.
Right. Right. And I think it's easier to do if we can hold them lightly. In fact, if I can read you just a couple of sentences from the book.
Sure.
Let's see. I talk about this. I talk about risk as a virtue and how to go about risking the potential loss of our convictions and the things that underpin our lives. And I say the willingness to risk is one thing. The emotional capacity to risk is quite another. It calls for an inner strength that few of us can muster alone. This is where inner transformation comes in. When we enter into this relationship with God, we no longer need to muster the inner strength alone, because we no longer are alone. And I can imagine, and actually, I don't know, this probably breaks 10 different rules of interviews, but I would be interested in hearing you connect that to the angelic realm too, because to me, one of the things that you offer and that angels offer is this profound sense that we're not alone. And I would think that sense of comfort might be fertile ground for people to be able to reach out to others.
Yes, because my feeling is, and my part of the work I do too, is educate people on how to utilize the angelic realm for their own purposes.
Mm.
I believe the angels, to me, are our helpers, and, you know, I don't think they're at the, I don't want to say disposal, but I'm trying to find the words here. They're here to help anyone and everyone in need. And
right.
That's part of what I like to do is educate people. I've had past shows on how to use different archangels, my next book will be about angelic living, daily angelic living, how we can use angels in our everyday lives. Because we are all connected. The angels are connected to all of us. They have no biases. They have no prejudices. Just because you're, Muslim or you're Catholic or whatever doesn't mean that certain angels apply to you. They're there at our disposal to help us.
Right, right.
You know, and that's what I feel the angels do. And I love the angels myself because they were there during a very turbulent time in my life. Well, I've had a lot of turbulent times in my life. I think that sometimes God puts us through, not God, but, you know, we are the strongest. Some of us, God gives us the most to the strongest, I believe, sometimes. I'm not trying to be prejudicial. I'm just saying that's
right.
And the angels have been there for me, and I want to teach people how they can be there for them as well, because people do feel lonely. They call me. There's a lot of loneliness. Maybe they're in a breakup. Maybe they're in a financial crisis. Maybe they've lost their job. You know,
mm-hmm.
The angels are there to help them. So that's kind of what I feel the angels can do.
So it's almost as though you had the experience where you received assistance and
yes.
and your enthusiasm bubbles over, and now you have to tell people because you want to help them.
Exactly, because I think you and I have in common is that we want to get a message across that, you know, just because with you, I think it's about dialogue and how to reach some kind of common ground and commonality, okay? With me, it just feels like, you know, you've been helped by your area of life. You're very passionate about it, just like I am with the angels and, crossing over to the other side, been there twice, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to my mother about this the other day, believe it or not, you know, about death and everything. And my father's very ill, and we think he's not going to have much more time long. But that's okay because, you know, but I've been to the other side twice. So, you know, and I come across to people maybe uncaring, but, you know, I'm like, Mom, we go home to God, and that's okay. You know, and that's where, Dad's going, and, you know, because she was talking about cremation and so on. So I said, Mom, this body is like a vessel for spirit or your soul to kind of hold into. You know, if you want to get cremated or whatever, it's okay because you're going to be going back to, you know, fish food anyway, you know. So
right.
I didn't say it like that to her. But, yeah. So she's like, oh, you should see something lit up in her head. My mother, I love her. She's 77 years old. God bless her. But, you know, so that's what I'm saying here. We all have some commonalities, and if we're open to people's thoughts and perception, maybe we can learn something and broaden our own understanding of things. At least that's what I've learned throughout the years.
I agree. I totally agree with that, yes.
Yeah, so, yeah, and you talk about, I thought it was interesting towards the end, you talk about spiritual practices in the book, and one thing really was cool was spiritual practices for the way of dialogue. You talk about silent prayer. You want to explain a little bit about that? I like that because I use silent prayer before I go on the air all the time. I pray to the angels and God that I have the right voice.
Oh, yeah, right, right. In fact, I was doing a little bit of that before I came on as well. I have always found this practice so rich and so delightful. And there are so many ways to do it, both within and outside the traditional realms of Christianity. Silent prayer, people engage in what's called centering prayer, which is very much like having a mantra, where you essentially repeat the word to yourself and use that as sort of a vessel to focus your attention on God. There are some people who use icons as they say, a window to the divine. There are just so many different ways. There's the rosary, which I use periodically, even though I'm not Catholic, and I know you do say it out loud, so it's not exactly silent, but it is for me. And there are just lots of ways to do that. One story I tell in Why Can't We Talk is a story that I read in a magazine called The Church Herald, where there's this gentleman in France who goes into a church every day, and he sits down and he looks at the crucifix, the Christ on the cross over the altar, and he just sits there, and about a few minutes later he gets up again and leaves, and the priest is wondering, what on earth is this guy doing? So eventually his curiosity was too much for him, and when the gentleman was leaving one day, he walked up and he said, I really have no idea what spiritual practice you're using. What are you using? And the fellow looks at him and says, it's very simple. I look at him, he looks at me, and we're happy together.
like that guy.
I know. I feel like, wow, you know, we have so many techniques, and so many of them are really good and really fruitful. But I think he nailed it. I think that's the very, very essence of it is, you know, we kind of look at the divine looks at us, and that change starts to happen. And it's a wonderful thing because I think it delves beneath the realm of emotion as well. One of the nice things about these practices is consistency is definitely a virtue when practicing them. If you can practice it daily, it's really great. But the one of the nice things is that you inevitably practice it when you don't feel like it. And somehow what that does is I think it gets underneath the realm of feel like it, not feel like it, how do I feel? And it builds this sort of ground of spirit within us. It tills the soil of our soul, to use a metaphor, so that we become more like the people we're meant to be. Not
yeah.
sure if that makes sense, but...
Yeah.
I'll let you be the judge of that.
Yeah. Well, when you are trying to help people or are attempting to through works of writing or whatever, it's left to interpretation. And I think that people who I love praying. You know, that's one thing I got away from for a very long time was prayer, and it helped my soul getting back into it. And I actually got when I sent you that interview with John Mundy, A Course in Miracles. I was listening to Marianne Williamson on Oprah and Friends, and every day I listened to her show, and she would do prayer. And that got me back into the mindset of prayer. It was really odd, but it helped me. And I'll tell you what, it helped balance, you know, the turbulent time I was going in my life, which was a very turbulent time about 4 or 5 years ago. It really got me centered and got me going ahead. It gave me a little bit more of a boost of faith. And I think that's very important for our people to understand that prayer, whether that be staring at, you know, a God of their understanding or whatever, is very important, especially you know, in this world. So that's just my little, you know, editorial on that. But, you know, I really like the book, John, you know, because we're running out of time. I really enjoyed it. It was really good. It's very, you know, people just want to have a better understanding of their fellow man and maybe... And you talk about, which we don't have time to go into, about gay, lesbian issues. You had your own experience with that.
Yes.
You know, I think that this is a good book for people to really pick up. It's a quick read. It's not real. And, you know, I mean, it's mind-boggling, but it's not like where you're going to be there days, like, scratching your head, like, what the heck.
I hope not. There's nothing like those books where all of a sudden you run into something and say, what is he on about anyway?
What is he ragging on about? No, where can people find your book, where can they find you? And, you know, let people decide, because I think this is a really,
sure.
This is on must read, definitely.
Sure. Well, thank you. You can find it, first of all, at the publisher, Skylight Paths Publishing, and it's skylightpaths.com. They publish books from all kinds of faith traditions, really great people. It's also on Amazon. You can go to type in Backman, Why Can't We Talk, and it should come up. As well as Barnes & Noble, your independent bookstores, pretty much any, as I say, anywhere fine books are sold.
Okay, great.
And website. I try to write weekly for my blog, which is on dialogueventure.com, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, venture.com. And that explains a little bit more about the book. It includes some other links. Includes a whole bunch of other writing.
Great.
Mm.
Well, John, this was a delight. This is really a delight to talk and, you know, really open our minds to stuff. I really appreciate it. I look forward to the next book if there's a sequel.
there will be something. And Amy, I have had such a great time. This is so much fun, and I appreciate your having me on.
Anytime, John. You have a great day, and to everyone out there, may the angels carry you through. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.